The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live expressed from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through this Super Bowl Sunday show, as always. Every year we do this on the fifth day of February 2017 this year. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll talk to former Foreigner frontman and jukebox hero Lou Gramm. He'll join us. Up next will be the New York Nets power forward. Tim Bassett will speak to us. Then we'll welcome in New York Giants Super Bowl champion and Hall of Famer Harry Carson. Finally, we'll hear from the Met fan extraordinaire, comedian Jim Brewer will join us. So sit back, relax, enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. Some great, great guests ahead in the next few hours. Right now, I'm going to turn it over to Brian, and we're going to, it's pre-recorded, our interview with Lou Gramm. I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. All right. Well, my next guest is a native of Rochester, New York. Got to be a genuine rock star and definitely a real jukebox hero. Best known as the lead singer for the classic rock band Foreigner. Welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Mr. Lou Gramm. Lou, good evening.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
It's great to have you with us, Lou.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Wonderful. Now, you grew up in Rochester, Gates Chilai High School, Monroe County Community College. Talk about the early days in Rochester.
Well, it was great times. I started playing drums when I was about 8 years old, and eventually in high school was in the Gates Chilai marching band.
Nice.
That was fun. We played halftime at Cornell Colgate 1 year.
Ooh. Yeah, pretty good.
That's a serious rivalry.
Yeah, definitely.
And that was a lot of fun, and by the time I graduated, I had a set of drums and was squarely right in the middle of wanting to be in a rock band.
Okay.
And not necessarily a top 40 band that covered everybody else's material. I was a guy that wanted to write my own material and
sure.
and make a name for the band and take a shot at recording, you know.
Definitely, yeah. Now, I went to Oswego, which is right down the road on 104.
There you go. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
So I'm familiar with the area, with the snow situation.
And lovely.
You ever been to the House of Guitars?
Many, many times.
Yeah,
many
okay, because I remember going there in college. That was a big deal because we'd hear the ads on MJQ and CMF, et cetera. And
the billboards, Armin Schobrock Steels, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yep, for sure. Now, you ever hear of the Good Rats?
Oh yeah, very much so.
Because they're from Long Island here.
Yep. Pepe
Marcello.
He passed away, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, he passed away recently. They were very big on the upstate college circuit at U of R and RIT, very big upstate. I just want to know if you had ever heard of those guys. And
absolutely.
Okay. Now, how did you start out in the business and some of your early influences?
Well, after I played in a couple kind of top 40 bands to cut my teeth, I immediately formed a band that started doing all originals, and it was called Black Sheep.
Okay.
And our manager was the Northeast promotion guy for A&M Records.
Not bad.
His name was Jim Taylor. His name is Jim Taylor. And you know, he started getting us to the point where we were auditioning in front of producers and such and trying to get us to take that next step. Well, we managed to do a show in the Auditorium Theater in Rochester with Procol Harum.
Okay.
And they were on Chrysalis Records.
Chrysalis, yeah, that was Jethro Tull.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And a number of great acts were on Chrysalis. And as it happened, we opened for them that evening, and the president of Chrysalis Records was there. I'm trying to think of what his name is. It escapes me now. Anyways, he heard us and was interested. So he signed us to a single deal. In other words, put an A side and a B side together, and if it gets any kind of notoriety, then we would go on and finish an album.
Okay.
Well, they had no offices in the U.S. So of course the single came out and did well regionally for us, but really didn't make a big mark nationally, and so we were all done with Chrysalis.
And you later went on to Capitol.
Capitol Records, yep. And we did two albums for Capitol Records, and I think we were getting good reviews for the album, and we were scheduled to open for Kiss for a full tour. And we played in Boston the first night, which was Christmas Eve in 1974. And we got a standing O from the Bostonians.
Okay.
And we were driving home. Some of us were in a car, and the rest of us were in the equipment truck. The equipment truck hit a patch of ice, slid off the road, and tipped over.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, the people were just bumps and scratches, but the equipment was about 85 to 90% destroyed.
Oh, man.
And we asked Capitol if they could help us out, you know, by advancing us a little money from our royalties so we could continue the tour. And they said no. And we asked our parents if they could help us out, and they couldn't. So we had to bow out of the tour after the first show, and then Capitol dropped us.
And that was the end of Black Sheep.
It was the end of Black Sheep, and it was just about that time that I'd gotten a call from Mick Jones.
Mick Jones, right.
About a year earlier, Spooky Tooth, who Mick Jones was the guitarist in, played at the Auditorium Theater in Rochester, and since they were on A&M, our manager took us to see them. We met them, and I gave Mick the two Capitol Records albums and thanked him for the great performance. Well, right after the truck smashed, you know, some 8 months later, and it looked like it was the end, he called and wanted to know if I would come down to New York and audition for a new band he was putting together. And I told him no.
Okay.
Because I still believed in Black Sheep and what we were doing, even though things were, for all intents and purposes, over. You know, and he called back about 2 weeks later, and I told him I'd come down and audition. I did go down and audition, and I got the gig.
The rest, as they say, is history.
Yes, it is.
And that band was Foreigner.
Yes, that's correct.
Definitely. Okay. We got Lou Gramm with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, Circus Magazine. We all remember Circus. We remember Cream, those publications.
Absolutely.
1978, you release Hot Blooded. I remember that. They say that Lou Gramm had a voice that Robert Plant might envy. What do you think of that, Lou?
I thought that was quite a far-fetched compliment.
Okay, yeah. So we didn't know where that guy came up with that. All right. Now, the first singles cracked the Billboard Top 20, the first eight singles. Now, that's the first band since the Beatles to achieve that, so that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it is. We were you know, in Seventh Heaven, but the weight of that as a statistic started bearing down on our shoulders, you know, and we realized that we couldn't let off at all.
Right. After that, yeah, there's no turning back. Yeah. Now you co-wrote most of the songs for Foreigner. And two of the biggest hits were ballads. Talk a little bit about that, writing a ballad versus writing a rock and roll tune.
Well, it's different, but it's the same. I mean, you gotta open up and really let the emotions come out unabashedly and what they are it was great writing Waiting for a Girl Like You. That was a terrific song that that really stayed at number two for 6 weeks.
Yes, you know, it did.
We were right behind Let's Get Physical.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
And then that finally dropped to number two, and we dropped to number three.
So you never made it past Let's Get Physical number one. Now, man.
Right.
And then you had I Want to Know What Love Is, of course, which was a number one hit in the U.S. and the U.K.
Yes. Now I worked with Mick on that all the way. We spent, I don't know, three and a half months crafting that song and making sure everything about it was just right, and the melodies, the words, and everything. And you know, when the song was recorded, he didn't offer me much of anything.
Yeah,
in writing. And so that was the first sour chord we hit.
Yeah, I was just about to reluctantly bring up you and Mick, kind of a volatile chemistry. You had many a chart-topping hit, but you clashed artistically many times.
That's true.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't think that's out of the ordinary. I think most teams, whether it's music or sports or acting or whatever, you know, there comes a point when people see things differently.
Yeah. Now, the following Double Vision, the album Double Vision, shifts in personnel in Foreigner begin to take place. And after Head Games, we remember that one, you guys decided to reduce the amount of guys in the band from 6 to 4. What happened there?
Well, I think that after Head Games, that was the first, you know, we talked a lot about that album after it came out, and we weren't satisfied with the song content. We didn't seem to be breaking any new ground. If we were going to continue this, we needed a shake-up. And the other thing was, it seemed that when people got home from the tour, they put their instruments in the rental locker in New York, and sometimes didn't touch them again until the next tour.
Yeah, not too good.
Nope. So, you know, especially if you're going to create, you certainly better have your chops up.
Definitely. Now, and the following album, ironically, was titled Four.
Well, it was our fourth album. And,
yeah.
And there were four people in the band.
Exactly. Not too pointed there of a reference, right? Now, you wanted the band to remain truer to a pure rock band. Mick Jones liked the synthesizer, the 80s stuff that was coming out of England at the time. How did you guys find a happy medium there?
Well, I think that especially in Four, I think we had a good balance of you know, both styles of music, and you know, there could have been some slower numbers, but even they were heavy, you know, and there was a ballad or so, but it wasn't the song that the record company gave all its push to, and we still believe that we were first and foremost a rock band.
Right.
And Waiting for a Girl, I think, was the number two or number three single from that album, and we had Urgent before it, and we had other strong songs after it.
Right, yeah, Urgent. Of course, remember that one, folks.
Yeah, so, everything was still okay. It's the next album that, that, that the walls started coming down.
That was Agent Provocateur, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. It took you guys about 3 years to get that one out because differences between yourself and Mick, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
He began to get immersed and really enamored with synthesizer. And when he and I would get together for writing sessions, we would be creating around, instead of guitar riffs, it would be synth riffs. And I had a tough time relating to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the songs were good, but the sound didn't grab me the way the guitar songs do.
No, not at all. Now, we're speaking to Lou Graham tonight from Foreigner on Sports Talk 1240. Your solo work, your first solo album, Ready or Not, comes out in 1987 to critical acclaim. And you have a top five single. Talk a little bit about starting your solo career, Lou.
Well, we started in around late 86 and 87. I think that after the tour supporting that the Agent Provocateur album. No, I could be wrong. I think it was the one after that. The album after that was
I don't remember.
At any rate, we started writing and recording at the end of 86, and the Ready or Not album came out in 87, and it was a rock album. It wasn't everything wasn't double tracked and frosting on it and all the stuff. You know, it was a don't mess around rock album. And we got critical acclaim, and the first single, Midnight Blue, was I think it broke the top 10, and at the end of the year, it was the most played rock single in the country over Can't Find What I'm Looking For by U2 and a number mm-hmm. of other very strong singles, but Midnight Blue was the most played single for that year. And I felt vindicated.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
There you were on top with your kind of music. Now, there was an opportunity to come back and tour with Foreigner, and you went back.
Yeah, that was after my second album.
Yeah.
And Mick had pretty much said it was, you know, technically I was still with the band, but Mick said it was time to do a Foreigner album, and I was set to tour with Steve Miller.
Right.
And I think Atlantic Records basically dropped their support, their publicity. And were pressuring me to get back in the fold and record a new Foreigner album. But you know, when you work real hard on an album, I've always been taught, and I've been taught a lot by Mick and Ahmed Erdogan and you know the big guns at Atlantic Records. When you record an album and you release it, you go out and tour to promote that album and get the most out of it.
Right.
And give it everything you've got. So now they're asking me, I released my Long Hard Look album, and I had a single Just Between You and Me. They were asking me to, before I even went on the road, they're asking me to come off the road and start working on a new Foreigner album. Basically leave my album out there dangling till
right.
it just
yeah.
disappeared.
Not good.
And I told them I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. I learned that when you release an album, you gotta pound the pavement and make sure it gets heard. And so I continued my tour. And when the tour was done, I'd been replaced.
Yeah, they brought in another guy. How was it touring with Steve Miller?
It was great. I enjoyed it a lot. His band was bunch of good guys. You know, they didn't kill themselves. They always had a little little pot and a little beer, and they'd go on stage, and they were excellent on stage, and they made sure that we had enough room where we could perform, and you know, it was a very good tour.
Yeah, real pros.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Now, as you say, Lou, they brought in another singer for an album called Unusual Heat. Now, this guy was not accepted by the fan base at all.
Not really.
Yeah. So Mick Jones contacts you again to come back in and record a couple of songs for a compilation album.
Well, he asked me to. He was in L.A. and he asked me to fly into L.A. and talk with him, and that the flight and the talk took place during the L.A. riots.
Nice.
So when I was coming in for a landing, they moved us from LAX to what's the other airport out there? John Wayne.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And as we're coming in, I could see smoke pouring out of buildings in L.A. It looked like the old black and white World War II.
Yeah.
Pictures of Berlin. You know.
Unbelievable.
Yep. And apparently they shut down LAX because people were shooting at the planes.
Whew.
So we went into John Wayne, and I got picked up by a plain black town car, and we drove into L.A., and we you know, a lot of streets were blocked off. It was a long and sweaty trip, you know. We weren't sure where we were going to end up. But we finally got to the hotel, and it's a good thing I got there when I did, because later that day the mayor made city of L.A. under martial law.
Yeah. Yeah, so we remember those days.
Without a good reason, you can't be out in the streets after sundown.
No.
And all the important buildings and hotels and stuff had rifle-bearing snipers on the roof.
Gee. Yeah. Not a good situation.
In case it gets bad.
Yeah.
And so there was no place to go, really, and not much to do. So under those circumstances, Mick and I, who we hadn't seen each other in two or three, maybe longer years, got together and started talking about what it would take to get the two of us back writing and performing again.
Excellent. Okay, now... You did some Christian music along the way.
Well, that came only about 4 or 5 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. And give us a little insight into that.
Well, you know, back when Foreigner was garnering its success, and there was more fun to be had than we should have had. You know, it got to the point where I realized, and I could see it in a few other guys in the band too, that I was in trouble.
Yeah.
And
you ran into some difficulty. Yeah, we know.
I did.
It
was addiction.
Right. Happens to the best of us too.
Yes, it does. And we played Madison Square Garden one night and standing ovations, and brought back for another couple songs, and then the Atlantic Records people took us out. We had dinner, we had drinks, and everything else that goes along with it. And I found myself getting back to my hotel room at about 4:30 in the morning, and I had a 7 a.m. flight back to Rochester.
Yeah.
I knew I wasn't going to make that flight.
No.
So I just tried to relax and get that stuff out of my system as fast as I could, drinking a lot of water. And about 7 or 8 o'clock, I called my attorney and told him that what the situation was and that I couldn't go home. And that I had heard about a rehab place that had good results, and it was a place that a lot of sports people and entertainers had gone to get themselves straightened out. I asked them to book me for a month into Hazleton in Minneapolis, in Minnesota.
And they took care of you.
He got me in there. He got me a flight from New York to Minneapolis. And when I got off the plane, right at the gate, there were a couple people from Hazleton there to more or less take me under my arm and walk me to a van. And they got my luggage, and I was on my way. And I treasure the time I spent there. It was not only a healing time, but it was an eye-opening time. You know, the place was packed, and you gotta open up, and you have to tell everybody who you are and what you do, but you tell your story. You know,
right?
How you became addicted to whatever you were addicted to, and some of the stories were stunning and heartbreaking. I also saw a psychiatrist while I was there. They feed you very good, you know, and they help you clean out physically and spiritually.
Excellent. And you got yourself back on the straight and narrow.
Got myself on the straight and narrow, thank God it's been over 26 years that I've been clean and sober.
Outstanding, Lou. What a great accomplishment. I was going to ask you, what's your greatest accomplishment? Do you consider that one of your greatest accomplishments?
I certainly do.
Yeah.
I certainly do. Because you hear so much about people who go to these places. I had been to a few other rehabs, and you know, there was one that I went to that they dropped me off at the airport, and I went through security and went right to the bar.
Right. I was just going to say that. Yeah.
So, I was clean about a month, and as soon as they dropped me off, my sobriety ended.
Bingo. So, yeah.
Just like that. And I believe that not only was I not ready, but whatever they were putting out there didn't reach me.
No. Yeah. That's unfortunate. Now, how about your greatest thrill along the way? Playing the garden, all the singles.
Huge. Yeah. Playing our first big show was Day on the Green in San Francisco, Bill Graham production.
Right.
We also played Cal Jam 2 in front of about 300,000 people.
Not too bad.
Now let me tell you about that quickly, if you got
go ahead, time. Sure.
We were recording the Double Vision album when they asked us to play, okay, Cal Jam 2. So we went out there and we played every song on the first album, and we came off stage and they were stomping their feet and cheering and screaming, and Bill Graham says, go ahead, guys. You know, we were the opening act. We started at 7 in the morning.
Wow, yeah.
Okay, and we looked at each other and we said, we don't have anything to play. So Mick says, let's do Hot Blooded. Because we had the music down, and we had the chorus, Hot Blooded, check and see, but we only had one verse.
Ooh.
So we went out there, and I sang the first verse three times.
They didn't know the difference?
They didn't know the difference.
Nah, yeah.
And we knocked them over, and the response was so incredible, we decided to make that the first single.
Amazing. Great story. Yeah. Oh, boy. It just goes to show you, all you need is a riff, and you put it over on them, right?
Oh, totally. Mick really, in the years I've worked with him, he's the master of the riff that you can build a song off of. You know, he used to give me, well, in the old days, cassette tapes, and I'd play the tape at home, and it would be one riff after the other. He'd play it for about 35, 40 seconds, then there'd be silence, and then he'd come in with another one, completely different, but just as good, you know.
What's your favorite Foreigner tune, Lou?
I like Jukebox Hero.
Yeah.
The best. But there's so many of them that I enjoy playing, you know.
Yeah. Well, outstanding. Well, Lou Graham, it's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you tonight. Thanks for taking part out of your evening to be with us.
My pleasure, Bill. I enjoyed every minute of it.
Really appreciate it, and hopefully we'll be back with you soon.
You got it.
Take care. Lou
Bye-bye.
Graham, folks. Well, we'll be back with Sports Talk 1240 after these messages. Stay with us, folks.
All right, that was Lou Graham, recorded last month on GBB. I hope you enjoyed that interview. We will be back in one moment with Tim Bassett, so stick around, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your Gust Buster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240. WGBB on Super Bowl Sunday. Last I looked, it was 21-3. New England. So hopefully that'll continue. Lady Gaga is on the halftime show. She's probably assailing President Bush at this point right now. But my next guest played for the San Diego Conquistadors, the New York and New Jersey Nets, the San Antonio Spurs, and he spent some time in Italy. I'm going to welcome now to Sports Talk 1240, Tim Bassett. Tim, good evening.
Hey, how you doing, man? Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. Now, Tim, you grew up down in Washington, D.C. Who were your favorite players and teams as a kid?
Well, growing up, my favorite teams were in baseball was the Washington Senators.
Oh, okay.
Frank Howard was my idol, and I had a chance to meet him over my career, and he gave me an autographed baseball, 1960 rookie, National League Rookie of the Year, so I
treasured
that gift from him.
Big Hondo.
And then Gus Johnson of the Washington Bullets was my favorite basketball player before Wilt Chamberlain.
Okay, now, yeah, and folks around here may not remember, Gus Johnson, a great power forward, used to have some battles with Dave DeBuscher. And the New York Knicks back in those days. It was Wesley Unseld against Willis Reed, Jack Maron and Bradley. And in the backcourt, there was either Phil Chenier or Archie Clark and the Pearl going up against Walt Clyde Frazier. But, yeah, DeBuscher and Gus Johnson used to have some battles under the boards.
Yeah, I enjoyed watching those matchups every year. I mean, between the two of them, they would end up getting to face the Boston Celtics for the Eastern Conference
Right,
finals.
Yeah.
But boy, what a battle that they would have over the course of that year.
Exactly. Now, you spent 2 years at the University of Georgia. You're one of the first African-American athletes in the Southeast Conference, and you encountered some issues along the way.
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, during that time in our country, there's a lot of strife, and there were some things that everybody was dealing with, and I felt like being at the University of Georgia, I could set an example for the way things should be in life. And the University of Georgia obviously thought that, too, or they wouldn't have asked me to be one of the first African-Americans to play in the Southeast Conference. And so, yeah, I had some issues. There were places that didn't want me to eat in their restaurant and stores that didn't want to sell me things or would ask me to go around back. But, you know, listen, I'm a big city kid, and, you know, I probably just enough naive to just go and say, you know what, that's fine. You don't want me here. I'll go somewhere else, you know.
Yeah.
And probably that was the best thing to do at that time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I had read when I did my homework, Tim, that camera crews used to follow you around, and even the students used to take pictures of you as you went to class.
Yeah. It was a big deal for me to be at the University of Georgia. A couple of people did their thesis on me. And
wow.
They followed me throughout the first month or so, all the way up until the first game of the season. They followed me around everywhere I went, and they took pictures and movies and did things and put together a nice piece all the way up until my first game as a University of Georgia player.
Well, the first time the Bulldogs came up against the Kentucky Wildcats was on January 17, 1972. Now, you won that game. You had 27 points and 13 rebounds. And after the game, you had a little confrontation with Hall of Famer Adolph Rupp. And this will prove, folks, that not all nice guys are in the Hall of Fame.
Well, you're right about that. And unfortunately, he had no reason not to give me the respect that I should have been due
right.
based on my performance that night. And he refused to call me by my name, and me being the brash kid I was trying to find a way to get to him.
Yeah.
so I could make him know what my name was.
Right.
But, you know, fortunately, you know, cooler heads prevailed, and that didn't happen. And I figured by the time we went to play at Kentucky, you know, I could do something even better. Unfortunately, when I got there, they had a caricature of my body hanging from the ceiling with a noose around his neck.
Nice. Hung in effigy in Lexington,
yes,
Kentucky.
That's what it's called,
yeah.
Right? And, you know, that was the way of the world in the South, you know. And so, I mean, there was never any thought that I wasn't going to play. You know what I mean? They took it down before the game. I'm sure in today's times that would have been a big deal, and it would have been all over the news and ESPN and all of that. And
social media would have a ball with that, yeah.
Oh, unbelievably. And you know, it's unfortunate that those things occurred, but, you know, that was part of the price of growing up, and this country's growing up. You know, we had to learn to find ways to overcome those types of things.
Now, in that game in Lexington, Georgia lost 87-63. You did have 17 points and 17 boards, though, but lost the game. Now, some of your teammates were going to support you by sitting that one out.
Yeah, but that was never the you know, they would have done whatever they thought I wanted done. And for me, I wanted to play. I just wanted to play. I mean, my parents sent me to school to get an education. There was no such thing as me quitting and coming home because my parents couldn't afford to send me to college, and so I'm going on a scholarship, and I just felt that there were things I was going to have to deal with, and that happened to be one of them.
Right. Now, you went to look for Adolph after the game, didn't you?
Again.
Yeah.
again, as I said before, cooler heads prevailed, and they, instead of allowing me access to Adolph Rupp, they sent me to the bus, and I got on the bus and went back to Georgia.
Good for you. He certainly had an apt first name, Adolph Rupp, that's for sure.
Well, boy, he was something. You know, listen, Kentucky used to win all the time.
They did.
He was like, you know, Red Auerbach of the Celtics, and he was the man in the Southeast Conference.
And the arena is still named after him, I believe, to this day.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
I had gotten a phone call from the University of Kentucky when this story came out. It was in the New York Times a few years ago. And I talked to a young public relations representative from the University of Kentucky who said to me, "Hey, there's no record of you being hung in effigy here in our Coliseum." And I go, "How old are you?" He said, "I'm 34 years old."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, first of all, you weren't born. And secondly, why would the University of Kentucky keep a record of such a dastardly thing?
Why would they document, a hanging in effigy? That would be pretty stupid to do that."
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great story, though. Now, you had a buddy named Ronnie Hogue who was on the receiving end of several cheap shots when you guys played the Yellow Jackets at Georgia Tech. And you had a problem with them, too.
Well, you know, they had a coach. Their coach's name was Wack Hyder, and he was going for his 500th win as a coach, I believe it was. And we played in Atlanta, and Ronnie Hogue was one of my teammates also in high school. And so, he was receiving quite a few cheap shots during the course of the game, and they had some of their football players and other folks standing at either end of the court, and every time we came down the court, of course, we were called every name in the book.
Yeah.
And so this guy was hitting Ronnie, and at some point Ronnie said, "The next time this guy hits me, Tim, that's it." And so unfortunately for this guy, he did. And I turned around, and I saw Ronnie in the middle of a melee, and I ran down. I grabbed the chair, and I grabbed Ronnie, and I pulled him over the scores table, and we battled our way out of the arena, and we ran across the Interstate 80 and ran across the street to a motel across the street until someone could come and get us. You know, it was pretty crazy that night. And unfortunately for us, the Constitution, the Atlanta Constitution, blamed us.
Of course, yeah,
blamed
right.
Hogue and myself. It's I think there's a book out about it. I couldn't believe they said that they thought it was our fault that whole thing occurred.
Unreal. What was the outcome of the game? Did they suspend it, or what happened?
No, they Georgia Tech ended up winning the game.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just another example, folks, the way things were in this country, especially in the South. We're speaking to Tim Bassett tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, you're selected in the seventh round of the 73 NBA draft by the Buffalo Braves, and your rights were also picked up by the Conquistadors in the ABA. Why did you choose to go to San Diego?
Well, you know, that story, there was a war between the two leagues, of course, as you know, at that
right.
time. And what a lot of folks don't know, which is okay for me to say now, I had already signed a contract with the ABA prior to the draft. And I didn't know which team was going to pick me, but the NBA was supposed to not be aware of the fact that I had done that. But, of course, there are no secrets in these games and sports. Mm-hmm. So when the NBA found out that I had signed this deal, Buffalo just took a flyer and drafted me in the seventh round, which I probably would have been a second or first round pick by whatever team that picked me in the NBA, just as I was a second round pick with San Diego in the ABA. So I chose right. the ABA because I thought I would have an opportunity to play right away, and that's what occurred.
As did many guys. Had Billy Paltz on the show last week, and we were talking about that. He was selected in the NBA draft as well, and he chose to go to the Virginia Squires. So a lot of guys looked at the ABA as a way to fast-track to play basketball. Now, you went to the San Diego Conquistadors. The story there is the coach is Wilt Chamberlain. Amazing. Now, talk a little bit about Wilt.
Well, it would take me a full night to talk about all the adventures that we had with Wilt Chamberlain, but I will say that he was very influential in my professional career. You know, a lot of us come into the game with certain ideas. I mean, I was an All-Southeast Conference player. I was voted player of the year in the South. I thought that when I came in, I was going to make the All-Star team and I was going to lead the team in scoring, all these different things you think as a young collegiate going into the professional ranks.
Sure.
And after watching me play during training camp and having extensive conversations with Wilt Chamberlain, he said, "Look, Tim," he said, "you're never going to lead the league in scoring." He said, "but you're one of the best rebounders I've ever seen." He said, "you're probably going to guard the other team's best player, and you're probably not going to get a whole lot of notoriety for it." He said, "but you can have a nice career doing that." And he said, "it's up to you if that's the route you want to take. I believe that you would play longer in this league than if you thought you were going to go out here and score 25 points a night. That's not your forte. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not a stupid kid. And I looked and I said, you know what, I want to play.
Right.
And so the bottom line for me, and that wasn't any different than any other team I've ever been on in my life other than Georgia, I was always the guy who got the rebound, played defense, and was the unsung hero, which I didn't mind playing that role. So it was easy for me to conform to that, and that, as it turned out, was the best way for me to go.
Yeah. What's your favorite Chamberlain story?
My favorite Chamberlain story has to do with me. The first day of practice when he came in, he looked over this ABA. He didn't have a whole lot of good things about the ABA that he liked. He didn't know the players. He didn't know the league. And so when he first came in, we were having practice, and he decided that we would have a two-on-one drill.
Okay.
We would be the two, and he would be the one. So we were supposed to drive at him and try to score a layup on the two-on-one drill, and he blocked every shot for about 4 or 5 minutes. Nobody's shot hit the rim.
Wow.
And so one of my teammates goaded me into trying to dunk on him. He said, how long are you going to allow him to block your shot, Tim? And I said, yeah, you're right. He's blocked 3 or 4 of your shots. What are you going to do? It kind of goaded me into it. You know, that's what guards do to their big guys. And so we went up in our turn in the line, and we tried to set up a play where I was able to dunk on him. And we had everything set up just right, except when I got to the rim, Wilk didn't go for the fake. And he jumped and blocked the rim, blocked me, blocked the ball. And I fell out on the floor, and I was knocked out, and they had to break one of those caps of ammonia under my nose and wake me up. And he looked at me and said, young fella, you're a good player, but I don't like to be dunked on.
Oh, that's a good one, Tim. Yeah, now.
Yeah, that was my first introduction to Wilt.
Wilt the Stilt. Yeah, what a classic. Now, talk a little bit more about those Conquistadors teams. I mean, I was going up and down the lineup. It was like a who's who in the ABA. Caldwell Jones, Bo Lamar, Red Robbins, Warren Jabali, right?
We had some incredible players. We had Larry Miller, who scored 67
yeah.
points in the game. We had Stu Johnson, who scored 63. We had Travis Grant, who scored 50, 60 points in the game. And we had Bo Lamar, who at the time that we got to San Diego was one of the greatest college scorers of all time in Southwest Louisiana. So the only two guys who weren't scoring were Caldwell Jones and myself.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And Wilt brought Caldwell Jones into camp with him. So we ran. When I say we ran, that's all we did in practice, and that's what we did in the games. We ran. And we ended up tied with Denver for the final playoff spot that year. And we ended up beating them in Denver in a sudden-death playoff game to see who went. I had a tremendous game that game, and we went on to play Utah, and I had an outstanding playoff series, averaging 17 rebounds a game. But we lost to the eventual champion, Utah Stars.
Okay. Now, you come over to the Nets out here at the Coliseum. How did you get to the Nets?
Well, I got to the Nets because, in actuality, I was one of the few guys that played Julius Erving pretty tough. He averaged about 17 points a game against the Nets during the time that I was there, and I played him pretty tough. Julius and I had been friends during the summer in the Rucker tournament. We had won the Rucker tournament as teammates, and so I remember him saying to me at one time, he goes, Tim, if we had you on our team, we might win the championship, and I used to laugh at that. And
Lo and behold, right?
Yeah. And so the San Diego Conquistadors signed this kid from Minnesota named Mark Oberding. And he was going to be the new guy that was supposed to be the big star in San Diego, but he couldn't beat me out in training camp. So they had to make a decision. And they traded me to the New York Nets. And, boy, what a great thing that was for me, to have a chance to come back to New York and play with the great Julius Erving.
Definitely, and win a championship that year.
Yeah.
You had guys like Princeton's Brian Taylor, Super John Williamson. And did you back up Kim Hughes?
I played three positions. Usually in the first quarter, I came in to replace Julius.
Okay.
And then Julius would come back in, and I would slide over to the big forward spot. And then Kim Hughes would leave the game, and I would slide into the center spot. So I played pretty much from 3 minutes ago in the first quarter to the end of the half. As long as I wasn't in foul trouble, I would play all three spots.
Not bad.
And that's how it worked pretty much the whole year.
You have any good Julius stories?
Oh, great stories. I mean, you know, the famous dunk contest in the All-Star game prior to going out there, there were a lot of people saying that nobody could ever dunk from the free throw line. And so we knew that he could because he'd done it in practice. As a matter of fact, just before going out to the All-Star game in Denver, we were practicing, and at the end of the practice, he told me to lay down at the free throw line, and three times he jumped over me and did it left-handed. And I said, oh, we're good to go. Let's bet the house. So while all those folks who saw that for the first time out in Denver and of course, on TV and videotape and all the things, so we knew it already because we'd seen him do it before in practice. He was the most incredible guy that I've ever played with. Such a professional, such an icon, a gentleman. Never seen a guy who signed every autograph, talked to every kid. You know, it was something that I learned from him, how to treat the public, you know, because these are the people who support us.
Right. Yeah, the doctor, the good doctor from the University of Massachusetts. He did that at my basketball camp too, Tim. Took off from midcourt. Leapt at the free throw line and boom.
Yeah, it was
definitely
amazing to see.
Yeah,
and you know, a lot of, we talk about this. There's a lot of debates about who's the greatest dunker of all time, and of course, you know, you got guys like Vince Carter and Michael Jordan. And I always say there's some great dunkers, and then there's some great in-game dunkers. And I always thought Julius Erving was the greatest in-game dunker I've ever seen. I mean, the Michael Cooper Rock the Cradle dunk and the one over Walton, and I mean, you just don't. Those were just some incredible dunks that still stand up to today's dunkers, who certainly put on the show when they're in the course of a game.
I always tell the younger people, Tim, that Julius was doing it before the Michael Jordan was.
Oh, there's no question. I mean,
yeah.
And when he did it, nobody had ever seen it before.
Right.
And that's what made it so incredible. Plus, and the other thing about Doc is, when Doc was going for one of those dunks, you could see it coming, and so that gave you the anticipation and a chance to stand up and go, oh my God. Well, you know, and it was so, it would take your breath away. So it was never a surprise when he did it. It was, you just knew, you just didn't know what he was going to do because he had that hang time that very few other players have ever had, and he could go up in the air when everybody else was coming down. He'd still be up there.
We were fortunate to have him out here on the island for a while.
Now, yeah, we were very lucky.
The feeling about the merger with the ABA and the NBA, what did the players, speaking to your opposition, to your teammates, what was the feeling about the merger, and then how did they feel after the merge took place?
Well, I think for the most part, at the beginning, everyone thought that most of the teams were probably going to have a chance to be absorbed into the NBA. Then when it started to look like that wasn't going to happen, and then they, you know, started merging the ABA teams together and taking players from teams that weren't going to be absorbed and putting them on the teams that were still involved in the playoffs, like, you know, Kentucky got Caldwell Jones and Maurice Lucas was down in St. Louis. I mean, all these players that were playing for teams that weren't going to make it into the merger, then you start thinking, okay, what about those guys who are going to lose their jobs? There's a lot of guys who are not going to have a job at the end of this. But, you know, we wanted to be in the NBA, and, of course, the owners did too. We wanted to prove that we were just as talented as those guys playing in the NBA. And of course, after the merger, we certainly were happy to prove that we were that good. The worst thing that happened in the merger, in my case, was we lost a great player in Julius Erving when they had to trade him to Philadelphia. They put so much pressure on those ABA teams coming in. First of all, they did not want us to come in the NBA and win a championship. So the pressure was on. They started coming up with things like we had to pay Philadelphia $3 million. We had to pay the Knicks $3 million to move to New Jersey and the territory and this, which is why Julius wore number 6, because we had to pay $6
million. $6 million, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, we got no television money, no expansion money. We got nothing, you know, from the merger. So it's very difficult to operate a franchise with those things working against you.
With those financial constraints,
with the NBA.
Definitely. That was Roy Bowe, the owner of the Nets, who also owned the Islanders
right
out here. And unfortunately, to get his place in the NBA, folks, he had to pay $6 million to get Julius Erving over to the 76ers. And as Tim said, that's why Julius always wore number six. And that's a great story. Now, your time in the NBA with the Nets certainly wasn't as good. That's of course with the financial constraints on the Nets. You did get a chance to play with a Hall of Famer in Tiny Archibald, but you finished in fifth place in the Atlantic Division.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was a brief thing. The marketing strategy was Dr. J and Tiny A.
Right. Okay.
Dr. J was traded, and Tiny Archibald tore his Achilles tendon early in the season, and so he didn't play for the whole year. So certainly, our team was decimated by the loss of two Hall of Fame players, and whatever plans we had of making a mark in the NBA certainly went down the tubes with those two injuries.
Certainly. But Bernard King comes in 77-78. There's another Hall of Famer. Great ball player. Tell us a little bit about playing with Bernard, Tim.
Bernard King was one of the things I always remembered about him was he had a tremendous confidence about himself from the moment he walked in the door. You don't normally see that with rookies when they first come in. Usually they have to work their way through training camp, get past the veterans and the things that we force them to do as rookies, and Bernard was having none of it.
Yeah.
He said, when I come in, I'm going to be the man and you're going to see it. And he averaged 22 points a game. I mean, you could see the talent was there and that he was going to be a really good player. And so that first year that he played with us, boy, what an exciting talent he turned out to be.
Certainly was. We're speaking to Tim Bassett tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, you leave the Nets for the Spurs. How did you feel about leaving New Jersey?
Well, what happened with that was, again, as you talk about the financial constraints of playing in Piscataway at the Rack.
Oh, yeah, at the Rack, yeah.
They didn't have a lot of money to pay, and, you know, I was one of the higher-paid veterans on the team at the time, and they decided at that point in time that they would rather go with Bob Elliott and Cliff Robertson, who were making less money than me.
Sure.
And they wanted me to retire and become one of the first African Americans to work in the front office. And I thought about it for a while, and I said, you know, I don't know that I want to travel around anywhere anymore. And I said, I got an opportunity to do something else and be a pioneer and open up some doors in the front office, and so I took the job working with the Nets in their front office. At some point during the season, the San Antonio Spurs, decimated by injuries, happened to come and play the Nets in Piscataway, and they saw me doing something during the course of the game. And I went home that night. I got a phone call at 5 o'clock in the morning. They had talked to the owner of the Nets and asked if they could release me to come and join the Spurs for the rest of the season in the playoff run. And so they wanted to know if I wanted to play. And I said, well, you know, yeah, I'll go. I'll do that as long as I have the ability to come back to the front office when the season is over.
Uh-huh.
That was the biggest part of the deal for me. If they didn't allow me to come back, then I probably wouldn't have gone over to San Antonio and played. And so when they said they would do it, then I left for San Antonio, and I had a opportunity to play with the great George Gervin.
Exactly, the Iceman. For those folks who don't remember or weren't around, what Tim and I were speaking about, the Rack is the Rutgers Athletic Center, and the Nets had no place to play in New Jersey when they moved there, so they took up residence at Rutgers before they moved to the Brendan Byrne Arena. Now, those were some days and some times, as we spoke about with the financial issues of the Nets. Now, of course, they're at the Barclays Center, but they still haven't returned to the form that they did in the 70s with Dr. J.
You know, it's the thing that, and this is what you learn about sports, when you have an opportunity to have a Dr. J, a Michael Jordan, you know, those kinds of players, you don't trade them. You don't. These players come along once in a lifetime. And when we traded Julius Erving, this ball club has not fared well since, other than during the Jason Kidd era when they had a chance to go to the finals two times.
Right.
But for the most part, it has been a very difficult road for the Nets, either in New Jersey or in Brooklyn, as they're dealing with those same issues right now.
What made you want to go to Italy, Tim?
I didn't.
Oh, all right. Okay.
They kept rolling wheelbarrows full of lira in front of me. and you know, it sounded like a lot of money. It actually was a lot of money, but it sounded like a lot of money. And I kept saying, boy, I can't keep turning this down. So once again, I asked the Nets management, would it be okay for me to leave the franchise and go in Italy and go play in Italy? Mm-hmm. And hopefully I'd have a chance to come back and work in the front office again when I left Italy. So that turned out to be a very good deal as well. We had a chance to win the Italian championship over there and played for the greatest Italian team in history with two of the best players that ever played over in Italy, including Dino Minaghin, who is actually in the Hall of Fame here in America.
Okay.
He never came to America to play, but he was Mr. Europe about 10 years in a row. And so I played with him, and the other player played at Pennsylvania. His name was Bob Morse. And Bob Morse was probably the greatest shooter I've ever seen in life. He was probably too slow to play in the NBA, but if you gave him an eyelash, boy, could he bury a jump shot.
Man.
And so I had an opportunity to play with them, and we were like the traveling Los Angeles Lakers doing Showtime,
Showtime
while we were over there. So we had a really good ball club.
Yeah, I spoke a couple of weeks ago on the program to another guy who had, he had a tremendous career in the ABA, excuse me, in the NBA, but also had a lot of success in Italy, was Bob McAdoo.
Right. Bob came over after I was there, and Bob played in Milan.
Yeah.
And so just as I was coming back to the Nets, Bob McAdoo came over and played with Mike D'Antoni.
Mm-hmm.
He played in Milan. And Dino Minaghin, who was my teammate, left that year to go to Milan. So that would have been, I played one more year in Italy without Bob Morse and without Dino Minaghin before I retired completely and came back to America.
Okay, what along the way, Tim, you've had an illustrious career. Greatest thrill or some of your greatest memories?
Well, first of all, one of my greatest memories is I still hold a record in the ABA for offensive rebounds in one game. I grabbed 18 offensive rebounds against one of the best rebounding teams in the league, which was the Indiana Pacers. They had George McGinnis, Roger Brown, and
Mel
Daniels.
Yeah.
Which was a pretty good team. And so I remember when didn't know that I had that many. When I got my 17th offensive rebound, the announcer goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Tim Bassett has tied an ABA record with 17 offensive rebounds." So Wilt takes me out of the game.
Oh, no.
So I'm sitting on the bench, and I'm sitting next to him, and he goes, "Man, you remind me of when I was in Overbrook High School with all those rebounds. You want to go back in there and get another one?" And I go, "Yeah, of course I do." So he puts me back in the game. And, of course, by this point, the Pacers are saying, "You're not getting another offensive rebound. That's not going to happen." And so Caldwell Jones was fouled, and he's standing at the free throw line, and I'm standing next to Mel Daniels. And he looks at me. He says, "There's no way you're going to get this rebound. You know that. If Caldwell misses, you're not breaking a record here in Indiana." Well, while he was talking, Caldwell shot. The ball hits the front of the rim, and I beat him to it.
Oh, man.
And that was how I ended up breaking the record. And so Wilt took me out of the game, and he goes, "Man, that was fantastic." He said, "You know, you're only going to have that record for a little while until I start playing."
Yeah, that's probably true, too.
Yeah, there's definitely truth to it.
What are you up to these days, Tim?
Well, now I have a place in New York City, which is one of the top spots to go to. It's called The Back Room.
Oh, yeah. Read about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a speakeasy that belonged to Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano. We do a lot of television shows. Boardwalk Empire is based on that place, and we film a lot there. We have a lot of great flapper parties, and it's a very exciting place to go to, and people have been flocking there for the last 14 years now.
Amazing.
And so, it's been very exciting doing that.
Wonderful. Well, Tim, it's been an honor and pleasure speaking with you tonight. Thank you for spending part of your Sunday night with us. Really appreciate it.
It's certainly a pleasure, man. Thanks for having me on the show, man.
You take care. Tim Bassett, folks. Next up, we'll talk to New York Giants Hall of Famer and Super Bowl champ Harry Carson. So stay with us, folks.
views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.